Vancouver. And then on October 30th, Saturday, 7 to 9, First Unitarian Church, 12th and Salmon in downtown Portland. An international WILF member, Mary Lee Mumhouse of Rwanda, and Susma Pankul of India will be offering tales of women today as catalysts for demilitarizing U.S. international reactions and talking about a new generation of women advocates as the sustainable peace and human security, featuring United Nations Security Council Resolution 1325. And so that's a really a good one to go. And we're going to go to our pledge drive right now. We're going to go to Tony and Liz.
Back to you, Marvin.
Thank you. And we want to thank everybody from KBOO for calling in and pledging for us. This next year will be our 20th year on KBOO, and we're going to have our very first show. We're going to do the very first show we ever did. I have it on tape, and we're going to put it on CD, and then we're going to play it first of next year for our 20th anniversary. Brian is one of my favorite people because of his activities. Oregon's got a lot of really, really good people. You know, we had Walter Waters, who started the bonus marches, came from Portland. We have Joe Lewis and Jim Russell, who were both lived in Oregon, and they were both shot at Kent State by the Ohio National Guard. We have Brian, who lives here now. We have Bob Chenoweth, who was a POW in Vietnam, and he was also one of the seven members of the Peace Committee while he was in prison in the North, and he's from Portland. And we have Bill Byers. Bill Byers, a Korean War veteran. He's an atomic veteran, a big-time peace activist. And these guys are people that I really like and I really care about. So Portland has a long history of activism. And Brian, we met Brian, I don't know, a long time ago. And Brian, you were born in New England, right?
I was born in upstate New York.
Upstate New York. And we were talking, and you were telling me about how you got into service, which I thought was kind of interesting. You were an old man.
I was an old man. I was in graduate school in 1966 when I got drafted, which I didn't think could happen because I had a school deferment. And I was very much for the war. I was, I guess, what you'd call a chicken hawk. I wanted to kill the commies, but I wanted somebody else to do it. I didn't really want to be involved. I'd rather be in school and be safe. But I got drafted due to a loophole in the deferment law.
Wow.
And I didn't want to go in the Army, so I enlisted 4 years in the Air Force, but I was 25 when I went in, and that meant I was 29 when I got out. And when I was in Vietnam, I was... I turned 28 in Vietnam, which was, for a non-lifer, was pretty old.
Really old.
Yeah. But it also was probably one of the reasons that what I observed and experienced in Vietnam, I was able to process in a way different than if I had been 18, 19, or 20.
Mm-hmm.
So that was probably one of the reasons why I became so radicalized while I was in Vietnam, not thinking that that was going to happen to me.
Can you tell?
And most of that was because of what you saw.
What I saw.
Didn't see.
What I saw.
And what was that?
Well, it was kind of hard to talk about it sometimes, but
yes.
I had an extra duty. I was actually in charge of combat security of an airbase with five, six-man fire teams.
Down in the Delta, right?
Down in the Delta. Two mortar units, a medic and an admin unit. This was Air Force. I was actually trained as an Air Force Ranger, which I didn't think even existed. But I got an extra duty to assess the success of airstrikes during the daytime.
How did you go about that?
I simply, this Vietnamese colonel asked me to go and assess. I was one of the few sober officers on this base. I was
sober.
I was very conscientious because I was scared. And the way I deal with when I'm scared, I read and I study to try to figure out where my men should be placed on the perimeter at night. And so the base commander noted that I was very conscientious, the Vietnamese base commander, and he had new pilots coming in from Mississippi, Vietnamese pilots, and new jet fighter planes that had just been given to him by the U.S. And this was Vietnamization had started under Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
And this was in the spring of 69, so Nixon was freshly elected. And so this commander, Vietnamese commander, had a notion or had information that perhaps some of these pilots that were coming in, these Vietnamese pilots, were going to sabotage missions. So he wanted somebody like me, apparently, to go and assess whether they were missing their targets or not. And I didn't know what a target, I was so naive, so anxious, so ignorant. I was just assuming a target would be a military target. And of course I hadn't quite caught on yet that we had invaded the country. And so that what's a military target in a country that you've invaded? But at any rate, so he sent me with a Vietnamese lieutenant who knew the roads to go to these villages, or to go to where the bombings were. And, of course, I discovered they were villages. And
so you traveled by vehicle on the surface?
By a Jeep.
Uh-huh.
My Jeep.
Your Jeep.
My Jeep. And it was only like 5 miles as the crow flies from where Bintui, where I was stationed, was. And in 6 days, we went to 5 target areas, and they were all villages. They were all inhabited villages. They were all unarmed villages. And half the people on the ground that I could decipher were about 3 or 4 feet long. They were all napalmed. A lot of them burned beyond recognition. And I was in shock. Actually been kind of in shock ever since, and in a way about this is what war is, and we probably don't know hardly any of the details from day to day in any war. We just don't know unless we've experienced it. So that was in April of 69. And
Brian, we're going to be going to a break here in just a minute, so less than a minute, just a few seconds. So and Brian, you and I share. I was in 6970 down in the Mekong Delta, and I was at your base a number of times.
Were you at Kantoa City?
I was actually stationed in Bac Lu, but was up at Kantoa quite a bit. When we come back, I want you to think about and tell a bit what this bombing was, because we had the B-52s at night, and we had the jets and the fighters.
These were A-37s.
But we have people right now that are going to give you a chance to donate to help keep this program on the air. And we really appreciate you listening. We appreciate, with our 20th coming up, wouldn't it be cool if everybody donated $20 a month?
Now we're going to Pledge Central, back to Tony and Liz.
All right, we're going to go back to the program now. Thank you.
Boy, we're so glad that you have tuned in today. And thank you from all of our all of us here from Veterans Voice on KBOO Radio Portland for helping support Veterans Voice. It's a real honor for us today and for you listening to have with us Brian Wilson. And while we were talking in between, we share quite a few things. We were in the same spot, same time, some of the old men that were over there. But when we left off for the break, you had mentioned the bombing that you had to inspect. Would you go back a little bit? For those that don't know, what was going on? When were they bombing? How often were they bombing?
Napalm. Tell them what napalm was.
This goes back into the areas of, sometimes I don't even want to remember that I was doing it or that I was there, but, these bombings occurred, midday, A-37Bs, they were new, the new jet fighter the improved A-37s that we had just given the Vietnamese. They're not good for, where there's a lot of anti-aircraft. They're not highly evasive, but they're great at bombing at low altitudes. They would bomb at 300 feet, 300-400 feet. Remember, this is daytime, and these villages are unarmed, and so it's like a turkey shoot. And
we were told they were very, very accurate.
Yeah,
supposedly.
The bombings.
Well, there was nobody that I could see in these five villages that had survived unscathed. Most of the people appeared to be dead. Mm. I occasionally would see somebody trying to get up and then moaning. I could still hear the moaning of those that were still alive. The smell of the napalm, the smell of the chemical residue from the bombing, the burning flesh. I mean, I had a handkerchief over my face. I was crying. The Vietnamese lieutenant I was with was actually gleeful that this was all happening. And it was like so surreal that for years I didn't even think it happened. You know, how could this possibly have happened? But these were not B-52 bombings. These were a lot of which happened at night. But these were villages in Vinh Long province, north of the Ba Sac River, that some intelligence report would have said, well, they might have fed the VC. They saw a flash of light there at night or something. I mean, it was just, it was basically genocide in Vinh Long province when I was there in April of 69. So I know that this went on for years all over the country, and I just happened to see one little slice of it. And I was in the villages within 30 to 45 minutes after the bombing, so it was really fresh. And I would only be there because this Vietnamese lieutenant knew when the bombings happened, when they were over with, the planes that originated from Binh Tui. They were on their 15-minute missions. 15 minutes mission, and they could kill 100 or 200 people in each village in a matter of 1 minute.
Wow.
That's war.
Boy, that's horrible.
One of the things that happened, Brian, is being in the Delta, we were all paranoid. I was down there. I didn't know who the enemy was. I didn't know where they were. All you had was stories that there were enemies there, and you didn't really know who they were. And in flying reconnaissance in a Loach along with the Swifts on the river, remember one time when there was some kind of a flash from someplace. Who knows what it was?
Right.
And the guys on the boats immediately called in an airstrike, and
right.
We went up and
watched.
And it was, and you say, well, what provoked it? I don't know. All I know is there was a flash,
mm-hmm.
and it's amazing how fast those jets could be there, those planes could be there. And you wouldn't see them, and all of a sudden they'd just crisscross over a target. The black smoke would come up, and there's nothing left. And what the preference of bomb that was used was something called napalm,
mm-hmm.
which is like a jellied gas.
Yeah, it's a jelly right. gas.
And what happens when it explodes, it splatters. And then
well,
it just
rolls.
Sticks
like, it rolls like a canister rolling roll flames. I realized in the first village.
So you determined very quickly that there may or may not have been any reason to bomb these villages.
Well, of course, when I realized that we were the invaders, I did come to this realization after about 7 weeks in country. So anything we were doing was in violation of international law, with the United Nations
right.
Charter, our own constitution that says we have to uphold international treaties. So all the people I saw were fisher people, farm people in villages with no weapons. There was, except for machetes. So all I can say is my radicalization process has a foundation of these personal experiences, and I've been on a different path ever since.
Yeah, Brian, when after you did a year tour, right?
No, I was sent home after 151 days because I was so I was articulating my opposition to the bombings.
Oh,
and
good.
To the war, to my superiors every day.
Good. And so when they sent you back, How long were you still have left in the, Air Force?
I still had 1 year left, and I did it in Louisiana, and I wasn't sure. They did initially bring court-martial charges against me, but I never had a court-martial convened, and I got out after 4 years with an honorable, and I was just Christmases put in one day, and I was gone.
So when did you
go back to when you told someone that you were against the bombing? What response did you get?
Oh, they treated me, they marginalized me, or they called me. My commander called me a VC. That was the way he nicknamed me. Oh, you're just a VC.
For telling the truth.
Well, for telling, I just
like
couldn't.
It was.
I mean, I wasn't an activist, you know. I wasn't raised in a family that asked race questions. So this was all a new experience for me. Questioning authority, questioning how could this possibly be happening?
Right.
It's it's beyond comprehension, you know.
So how did they treat you when you came back to the States?
I was. I had a year to do in Louisiana, and they made me a supply squadron executive officer. Mm-hmm. I worked for a Major Ng, who was who had been a pilot in Vietnam, but he was now head of the supply squadron. He was very kind to me.
Mm-hmm. And so
that whole year, I was in trouble with the wing commander of the base. I was in his office a lot because they thought I was contaminating the atmosphere of the base with my... I had a little Volkswagen Beetle with flower decals on.
Good for you.
And I had to drive on the base every day because I didn't live on the base.
So they tried to court-martial you.
No, they never convened the court-martial.
Oh, they didn't. Oh, that's good.
I didn't know. I was anxious the whole time, but then I got out, and then I...
So finished. You never did know what the charges would have been for?
Well, they... Originally, they'd... There was 57 charges against me.
Wow.
Fraternization, sedition, disaffection, conduct of becoming an officer, blah, blah, blah.
All the good
blah,
stuff.
Blah, blah, blah.
All the good stuff.
But, you know, when I got out, I just finished law school and resumed my civilian life.
And then when did you really get into the peace movement? How long after you were out?
Well, I was when I was in Louisiana before I got out, I was very involved with the racial desegregation of the schools in Louisiana, and I was very active in a statewide committee. And this was my new life. Mm-hmm. I was a member of the local Unitarian Fellowship, which I didn't know anything about Unitarians before, but I was so excited to be actually thinking that life revolved around justice,
right,
which was a new idea for me. And so I was just like a babe in the woods, excited to be part of a life of with a different paradigm,
right,
basically. So in a way, my activism started in Louisiana before I got out of the military. And then when I became a lawyer, I did a lot of work on prison issues all over the United States for 10 years.
Wow. So when did you get involved in the veterans movement, veterans peace movement?
When I had a flashback in 1981, I had a psychotic flashback.
And you were living in where, Massachusetts?
I was living in Boston.
Oh, in Boston.
And I had to go to a vets group to get, I didn't know what had happened to me. I was reliving, looking at these people on the ground in this village, and it was so real, I thought I was actually there.
Right, it's a flashback.
And so I was shaken for actually several weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was going to a rap group. And I had to sit in this rap group and listen to a lot. See, I never thought of myself as a real vet. I was Air Force. I was an officer. I was not a grunt. I figured I didn't have any problems. I shouldn't have any problems.
But you probably felt, since you weren't there that long, that...
Yeah, and I was older. And
yeah, and you were older.
And I was sitting in this rap group and hearing these guys talking about what they were doing in the jungle, and I thought, man, and they were proud of what they had done here and there, and I was like,
I don't want to deal with that.
I'm not interested in war stories. I'm trying to get myself recovered into a human being,
right.
and here I have to deal with my own memories now,
right.
And I wanted to pretend that hadn't happened, you know,
right.
I was like, it didn't happen,
right.
But.
So when did you get involved in Nicaragua? When did you get involved with Central America?
Well, when the Sandinista Revolution prevailed in July 19th, 1979, and the coup in El Salvador happened in October of 79, I only know that because I was a prolific reader of of political activities, U.S. policies. And so while I was working on prison issues, I was always reading about what the U.S. was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the flashback in 81, I got involved with vets, actually. I was a director of a vet center.
Oh, really?
In Massachusetts, dealing with vets' claims, and still not thinking that I had any real serious long-term problems. And then while I was doing that job, I was speaking out every weekend against Reagan's policies in Nicaragua and El Salvador and Guatemala on the commons in different towns in New England. Mm-hmm. I would be actually speaking on Saturdays and Sundays. And then I resigned from the Outreach Center in 1985 and actually went to Nicaragua for the first time.
Okay, you went in 85 to Nicaragua.
I actually went in January of 86. Mm-hmm.
Did you, you know the story about Ben Linder?
Oh, right? Yeah.
Linder's from Portland.
I know, and I had ice cream with Ben Linder in the ice cream shop in Matagalpa exactly 3 weeks before he was murdered.
Oh, yeah, Elizabeth is wonderful.
He was murdered on April 28th, 87. I was with him in the ice cream shop on April 7th, I think mm-hmm. it was, mm-hmm. in Matagalpa. It was the only time I met him.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd been in the war zones for weeks and weeks before I met him, in the uh-huh. Nicaragua war zones,
right,
with other vets.
With other veterans, right.
Yeah, monitoring and observing and
right.
assessing
right.
what was going on.
So how long were you there in Nicaragua?
That time, I mean, I've been in Nicaragua 30 times.
Oh, you went 30 times?
Over the years, I've been there 30 times.
How about El Salvador?
Only 3 times.
Do you know Charlie Litke? Not Charlie Litke, but
Charlie Clemens.
Charlie Clemens?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
oh,
Charlie.
Yeah, definitely.
He's another Vietnam vet.
Yeah, who was a doctor in El Salvador working with the guerrillas in 82
Smurf.
And 83.
Smurf, he's part of Smurf.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you were down there and working with this, When did you meet Charlie Litke?
I met Charlie Litke in that first trip to Nicaragua in January of 86. He mm-hmm. was on a Witness for Peace delegation.
Right.
And I was on a vets delegation.
Mm-hmm.
I was a student at the language school in Esteli, but I was in Managua, and we connected somehow. Mm-hmm. And we immediately started talking about doing something when we got back to the States.
Yeah. And Charlie Litke...
Congressional Medal of Honor winner in Vietnam.
Congressional Medal of Honor winner in Vietnam. He was a...
Chaplain.
A Catholic priest.
Yes, and a chaplain in the Army.
In the Army, yeah, and he won a Medal of Honor.
Yeah, he was there 2 tours in
Vietnam.
Oh,
He was
a major.
Yeah.
And when I met him, of course, he was just outraged at everything that was happening. Mm-hmm. He wanted to return his medal.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. Did he actually return his medal?
I was with him on July 29th, 1986,
mm-hmm.
at the Vietnam Memorial.
Mm-hmm.
Placed it at the Apex.
Right.
In an envelope with a letter.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was 1 month before we started the Veterans Fast for Life.
Yeah, well, as soon as we come back from the break, I want to talk about that, too.
We are so privileged to have with us in studio today Brian Wilson, a veteran with a great history, and it's an honor for us, an honor for you to hear them. And we thank KBOO Portland FM Radio for doing that and letting us have Veterans Voice. Thank you so much for listening today to Veterans Voice on KBOO-FM here in Portland. We are so privileged today to have as our special guest in studio, right here, live, in person, Brian Wilson. And I've appreciated our chance to talk in between while all our good friends were calling and sending in money, and I wish you could have gotten in on a little part of the humor and his great smile and wonderful attitude that he has in life. And, Brian, we could spend probably another 2 hours just to get the introduction to a few stories.
Yeah, I want to talk. You know, when you came back, you and Charlie, and I can't remember who else.
George Mizo and Duncan Murphy.
And Duncan Murphy did the fast on the steps of the Capitol.
Right. Well, open-ended, water only. We did not have a plan to end the fast at any particular time. In fact, we weren't sure we would end the fast. It was truly open-ended.
Mm-hmm. So when did it, and whose idea was that? And
it was Charlie's and my idea. We cooked it up in Managua in January mm-hmm. of 86. We were inspired by the Irish hunger strikers
mm-hmm.
that had 10 hunger strikers that had died
Bobby
in 1980.
Sands.
Yep. That was an inspiration to us. We also knew Mitch Snyder, who was a homeless advocate in Washington, D.C., who went on long fasts and ultimately actually hung himself.
Yeah, suicide.
But Mitch had spent a lot of time with us during the fast on the steps, talking to us, encouraging us, because other people, like Charlie Clements, for example, didn't like the fact that we were fasting.
Yeah, well, he was a doctor.
he also was, by that time, he was into electoropolitics or supporting electoropolitics. At any rate, there was a, you know, we were there, and it was not unanimous that everybody thought we should be there, but we were there, and that's when we got put on the FBI's domestic terrorist watch list. Strange as it may sound, but after 47 days, we ended the fast.
Yeah. How'd that come about? I mean,
that came about because George was very sick.
Yeah, George got sick,
and we weren't sure whether what we would do if he died. Although originally our plan was that we all conceivably all would die, but when the first one was getting close, we had to rethink everything,
right.
So we wound up coming off the fast at 47 days, and then. All of us continued in various ways our political activities right up to till either we died. In George's case, he died 8 years ago. And in Duncan's case, in my case, in Charlie's case, we're kind of still activists.
Yes, definitely activists.
And Portland is fortunate to have you as a resident.
Oh, yeah. And we're lucky.
Brian.
Yeah, and so let's talk about when you were down at Concord Naval.
Yeah, I was at Concord Naval Weapons Station.
What year?
This was in 87, June, July, August, September 87. Concord was the largest Pentagon arsenal on the West Coast, and their weapons from there were going to Salvador, Nicaragua, and Guatemala. But before I went to Concord, I had, at the time I met Ben Linder, I had witnessed incredible carnage in the war zones in Nicaragua, including 400 amputees that I visited personally, bed by bed by bed by bed.
Wow.
So I was pretty intensely committed to challenging these policies, and we had lobbied and lobbied and lobbied, and you know how lobbying works in an oligarchy. You're basically petitioning the people who are your enemies, basically, or who are not interested in justice.
Was this down in Nicaragua, or was this up here you were
protesting? Lobbying in Washington.
Lobbying in Washington.
But so we decided to go, like Gandhi, go to the scene of the crime, go to the place where the weapons are coming from and directly block them. So that's what we started doing in the summer of 87, and then on September 1st, 87, I decided I would be with Duncan Murphy and one other vet, David Duncombe, who lives in White Salmon, Washington.
Yeah.
We decided that we would do a 40-day fast on the tracks and blocking every train that came in that 40 days and force them to remove us. Well, didn't know that Duncan and I were on the domestic terrorist list. So on that day, for the first time ever, the train, which had a 5-mile-an-hour speed limit, sped up to 17 miles an hour with armed Marines standing within 20 feet of us. And I went under. Duncan jumped straight up and grabbed the cowcatcher railing, and I was just about wiped out.
Yeah.
And the train kept moving, went over me, and my wife at the time, Holly, was just waiting to for the train to get over me so she could get to my body. Duncan jumped off the locomotive that he had jumped up on. He didn't leave the tracks. He jumped straight up and grabbed the front of the train, the cowcatcher. And there were two spotters in the front of the locomotive, so their job was to make sure the tracks were always clear. They were Vietnam vets themselves.
Really?
And so I wound up losing both legs and my right frontal lobe. I still have a plate in my skull. My right arm was broken. My right shoulder blade was broken. My right kidney was almost destroyed. All my ribs on the right side were cracked. my ear was cut off and sewed that back on. I mean, I've survived, so here I am. You know, what can I say? Another gift of a gift. You know, yeah. I'm still breathing.
Remarkable. So,
remarkable. I remember.
But I never stopped my activism.
Never stopped it. You kept going.
No way.
There's a thread that runs through. If you listen to our special guest today on Veterans Voice here on KBOO Radio Portland. That he has been consistent in telling the truth and telling what he sees. And there's been a lot of adversity, a lot of trauma, and a lot of things. But we are privileged to have you with us today, Brian Wilson. Thank you. And now you and the audience, you are there listening. We're going to go to Pledge Central so that you have an opportunity to be a part of this, because you are a part of Veterans Voice, and we thank you so much for listening. Well, this is a real privilege today to have you in our audience, as it is a privilege to have Brian Wilson with us here in the studio for Veterans Voice here on KBOO 90.7 FM. And a big thank you to all of you that have called in and made pledges and are sending in money, because we promise we're going to keep going maybe another 20 years. What we wanted to do here for you in the last time that we have is just let Brian talk to us and just tell us anything that's on your heart, Brian, because we only have about 3.5 minutes left, so just let it all out.
The name of the song, somebody called in one name of the song that we started, it's Good Night Saigon by Billy Joel.
I come from a very lower working class background in a rural community in upstate New York, and I had no preparation for a life of questioning and activism. It happened because of my experiences. I was considered a smart kid in school, but later I realized that being a smart kid in school was just meaning I was a very effective dumbed down person who would take orders to do whatever the system wanted me to do. And so I have a new understanding of what it means to be smart. It's different from being wise. So when I came back from Vietnam and I told my parents I didn't want anything to do with their church or their country or their God or their country, it was a shock to them, and it was somewhat of a shock to me that I could be that clear about the fact that I needed to start over again with my value system. And so when I look at the society today, a society that seems so dumbed down, so oligarchic, so vertical, so lacking of real avenues of expression of conscience, it's all the more imperative that people that have some sense of righteousness or justice or a conscience to kind of realize that our power as human beings is not in the government. It's not kissing their ass. It's not even paying them money. It's starting to understand we have to create our horizontal communities all over the world, including around in Portland, that operates almost parallel to the formal government structures, which are at the mercy of corporations. So we have to, I call it an epistemological break. We actually, it's like an evolutionary shift in the way we think.
Yeah,
beyond even a paradigm shift. It's almost like an epical shift in evolutionary proportions. And we know that if we don't do something fairly radical, we are likely not even to survive this century. Mm-hmm. So my path has been to see what I'm experiencing, and if it suggests another idea, I kind of go with that idea because I have learned that's how I've been able to survive. I started in Vietnam realizing that bombing children in villages just can't be a good thing to be doing. And then the war itself can't be a good thing, going into another country and violating their sovereignty.
Like we're doing now.
Just like we're doing now. So the power is with the people.
Hear, hear, Brian.
But it's not power to the people in a vertical structure. This is my, I'm a decentralist. So I really believe that the power is in people rediscovering what it means to be a human being outside of being an obedient, loyal servant to a an authority complex, and that has been my journey. My book is coming out in April. It's called Blood on the Tracks, The Life and Times of S. Bryan Wilson, and it talks about my whole journey from being a straight conservative little kid that wanted to be a Baptist minister to Vietnam and to traveling to countries all over the world, learning about U.S. policy, coming home and saying, okay, folks, we got to rediscover what it means to be a human being.
Yeah. You've been privileged to listen to Bryan Wilson today on Veterans Voice here on KBO FM Portland. Bill, we haven't been able to hear from you, but you want to say goodbye to everybody before we, in 10 seconds?
You got 10 seconds.
I'd like to say goodbye to everybody, and I'd also like to remind them that what a wonderful asset that KBOO is for the city of Portland and the surroundings.
Yep.
And you can, Marvin, thank
you. You can go on Facebook and put Bryan Wilson's name in, and you can see his blog and all of his stories that Bryan does every day on Facebook. And remember, Bryan Wilson is W-I-L-L-S-O-N.
Two L's.
Two L's.
And we'll see you next month on Veterans Voice.